Hello and welcome to the Gentleman's Journal podcast, a new fortnightly discussion all about success, modern business and the lives of entrepreneurs. I'm Joe Bullmore, I'll be your host for the day, and I'm joined this afternoon in the beautiful Indian room upstairs at Mark's Club by Henry Wyndham, for many years the senior auctioneer at Sotheby's and until October last year its chairman. He now runs the art advisory firm Claw Wyndham. Today, Henry talks to us about his first failed career as a door-to-door salesman, how auctioneering is all in the eyebrows, and how a shooting accident might just have changed his life for the better. So, Henry, as the senior auctioneer at Sotheby's for many years, you are, I suppose, its face and the kind of figurehead and the public face of a massive art institution. Did you ever look around and think, how on earth did I end up here in a position of such influence?
Well, how I ended up at Sotheby's.
Well, how you ended up as the kind of figurehead of the most famous institution all of the world.
Well, with
of
a
art.
Man who only got about one O level, I suppose. I do, really. Yes. I mean, I suppose it's being in the right place at the right time, isn't it, really? And I suppose I had the sort of credentials that maybe that they were looking for,
right.
In that I'm 6 foot six. That probably helped a bit. And also I, you know, could take auctions and I have a good network of people. And I suppose in a sense, and also I know something about art. I mean, in a way, I ticked a few boxes
right.
for the job. And yes, I think if I'd dreamt age 21 that I would end up as chairman of Sotheby's, I think I would have been very surprised. I would have said, you must be joking. So the answer is yes, surprising, yes.
And you mentioned your height there. Is the physical presence in an auction room an important thing?
Well, I think that, of course, it's not a vital thing, I think if you are a sort of reasonably tall, I think it does give you probably a little bit more presence. I mean, I don't know because I don't see myself, but I sense that it probably does help a little bit, and it maybe make you a little bit more imposing. I don't know, really. But I would imagine if Ronnie Corbett had been an auctioneer, he might have been a bit more challenged by the whole, but of course he was a very good comedian.
So maybe he would have been perfect.
Yes, he might have been very good. Who knows?
Do you think
he's a very funny man.
Do you think there's a kind of a crossover between performance artists like comedians and actors and a
well I think
auctioneer.
That it's funny you should say that because this thing about performing, I mean, I never was somebody who put my hand up and volunteered to stand up in front of people and perform. I was always a reluctant performer,
right.
And of course some people love the sound of their own voice. I never really have. But I sort of somehow took to it in some strange way. I don't know why. Mm. And found it is probably one of the very few things I was able to do reasonably naturally. And it's strange because it's quite counter to really what I really felt, you know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, I never liked reading the lesson in church. I never liked public speaking was something I never enjoyed. I actually got to handle it, you know, and I could do it and can do it. But aged 25, I can't think of anything worse than
really?
Standing up in front of people and having to perform. Yeah, it's absolute terror. But it's like all these things, it's about confidence, isn't it? And actually, public speaking and taking an auction are two very different things because one, you're working to a formula, you're being prompted to a certain extent by the audience. They're putting their hands up. And if you have the right language and the right technique, it sort of drives the whole action. Whereas with a speech, you basically are doing it on your own.
Yeah.
You don't have any prompts other than the notes in front of you. I mean, it's a very difficult, different skill, I think.
And if you weren't interested in the performance side of it necessarily, were you interested in art from a very, very early age?
Yes, I mean, the performance thing, I think, is actually I was interested
right.
in because I was always trying to get better and better. I mean,
okay.
I worked incredibly hard on perfecting my technique as an auctioneer. I looked at, watched other people. I took the bits that I liked from other people, which I always think is the best way to learn. So there were certain auctioneers who I admired, respected, and probably took bits of what they did and then combined it with my own technique and then that's really how I ended up. But I mean, to the very end, I always was searching to get better, really, and I think that's a good thing. I mean, you could never rest on your laurels. So I think actually the whole performance I took incredibly seriously. And, you know, if somebody entrusts you with a picture of £20 million, you know, they expect you to do a good job. And I think it's you know, it's the least you can do to make sure that you're performing to the best of your abilities. That's what I always felt anyway. I mean, for instance, you know, don't get drunk the night before, that sort of thing.
That's,
you know,
I think, good advice for life. Really.
If we go back to that 21-year-old Henry, who would be very surprised to perhaps see you now, what was your, what were you doing then? What was your first job out of school?
Well, I didn't go to university, which is a slight regret of mine. But I mean, just to be very boring about it, I rather mucked up my A-levels. I got hepatitis during my last summer term, and therefore really was in hospital for about 6 weeks before I took my A-levels. Didn't do particularly well in my A-levels, which rather screwed up any thoughts of going to... I was very keen on sport, very keen on cricket. I wanted to try and get a blue at cricket, but that wasn't to
presumably
be...
Presumably a fast bowler.
Well, not particularly, but sort of, you know, but okay, I wasn't too bad at it. And then, so what I did with 3 years was I sort of wandered around the world. I went to Australia, I lived in Paris for a bit. I did a fine arts course. I was a door-to-door salesman in Australia.
Wow. That was what were you selling then?
Well, I wasn't selling anything because I was so bad at it. I know I could sell anything, but in those days it was my first job in the art world, and I was selling views of Sydney Harbour, hand-coloured prints.
To Sydney residents?
To Sydney in the suburbs, and you can imagine a guy with a posh English accent, what they told me to do, which began with F and ended in K, you can imagine. And every single household said that, and I'm afraid I didn't sell anything. But it was a good learn. It was a very good reality check, and it really, I suddenly realised that life did not owe me anything, and I really had to make it on my own. It was a real good learning curve. I mean, six houses running where I knocked on the door and they told me to F off. I mean, you know, you soon realise that there are no benefits for you.
Yeah, but presumably it might have been easy if you were selling something that they didn't maybe see every day. And they looked at the Sydney Harbour Bridge.
I think also it probably wasn't the most, it was a bit rather a Philistine area of Sydney.
Okay,
and I don't think art really took much of a part. I think the target audience wasn't very good. Okay. So I started there, and then I did a fine arts course at Sotheby's, and then what else did I do? I went around America. I had a good time, and as I say, I went to the Sorbonne in Paris for 1 week. I lasted a week, which was a miracle.
Why did it end so soon?
Well, I don't know how I managed to last as long as I did for a week, but I don't know. I had other things on my mind in Paris in those days. And so I absorbed a lot of art. I lived in Paris for 6 months. I went around the Louvre. I looked at art a lot. And so I was always passionate, but my passion was sort of... I suppose it's sort of inflamed and I got more and more excited and enthusiastic about art. And then I got a job at Christie's, having been on the Sotheby's course, and I did 13 years there, which was a very good experience. I spent 5 years in America. In fact, I mean, the amazing thing was, I mean, I aged 24, I was then asked to run a department, which is the 19th Century Picture Department in New York, which sounds very grand, but actually it was just me and a secretary, and I knew nothing about my subject at all. So I had to start really from nothing. And I think it's a very interesting challenge, because there I was, age 24, knowing nothing about the subject. I knew about old masters, but not about 19th Century Pictures. And I really, it was a sink or swim.
Right.
And I think it's quite a good lesson that if somebody is young but naive and not necessarily knowledgeable, but has a little bit of talent and has the drive, I'm all for throwing them in at the deep end and giving them an opportunity. Because the thing is, you learn so quickly. I learned incredibly quickly, and I turned from being a sort of slightly hopeless individual into somebody who was far more driven. I realized it was up to me to succeed, and if I didn't, then I would be out of a job. And I think overnight I changed completely from somebody who had much more ambition.
Yeah.
And being in New York in the late 70s was a very exciting place to be. So it completely switched me on, really suddenly. And then I was far more driven and realized that I actually wanted success and ambition. So yeah. It was a very good learning curve for me. I am partly American, so I have I had a sort of relationship in America too.
And if you're looking, I'm not sure how involved you are in the hiring process of young graduates. Would you always prefer a graduate, as you say, who's ambitious but not qualified, or one who's very, very well read and book smart?
Well, that's a very good question. And actually, the thing that I find certainly in the auction houses today, certainly when I was at Sotheby's, that really you only got through the front door if you had a degree, which would mean that I wouldn't have. I mean, if I applied for a job now and I was 21, they wouldn't hire me. I mean, they'd hire me maybe to lift the furniture, but not to be an expert. And I think that's actually wrong. I mean, I always advocated against that because I think that people go to university and they learn all the academic skills and they are probably highly intelligent and intellectual and God knows what else. And that's great. Mm-hmm. But actually, there is also other skills that don't come through university education. And having an eye is one of them. You either have an eye or you don't have an eye, in my view. And if you don't have an eye, it's very difficult to create an eye. And I think to have commercial sense is something that doesn't come through a university education. Yeah. And in a sense, I think I fall into that category of somebody who hopefully had an eye, but also was highly commercial. So I knew if something was going to be something that would sell well or not, and I think that's actually the most important thing.
Yeah,
to be an expert in an auction house. But in the ideal solution is you have a bit of everything. You have a university education, so you have an academic background. You also are a good businessman, and you have a sort of good common sense and selling skills. So, but nobody ever has all the skills required. No. If you can tick 4 out of 5 boxes, you're doing pretty well.
And do you look at artists who have had kind of these meteoric rises like Adrian Genny, and do you ever find yourself thinking, what a load of old rubbish, or this can't hold its value?
Well, I think some artists, my only concern is, on the whole, you find a market that goes up very steeply tends to come down very steeply. That's my sense of it. I think there's some very good young contemporary artists, and who am I to judge? But I think some of the very good. I think it's always a bit of a concern when they go up so quickly, though. And you don't really know. I mean, I don't think it's up to us anyway to judge why people buy things. But I think there's obviously a lot of speculators there who are looking to make a quick buck, buy something, flip it in 3 years' time. But of course, there are a lot of people who genuinely want to hold on to things. So, you know, you when you sell something to somebody, you can't really ask them why they're buying it. No. I think that's a bit, you know, they're buying it presumably because they like it, or hopefully they like it. But it may be that they want to just turn it around and flip it. And that, I think, is difficult for the dealers, the gallerists who are selling these artists, and suddenly find they sell something to a man for $10,000 and then it goes into an auction, makes sort of $150,000, and it rather sort of distorts the market.
Yeah. And how emotionally attached do you get to certain pieces when you're up there auctioning them off? Do you ever really will things on? Or?
Well, that's an interesting question. I have managed, because I worked in the auction field for whatever it was, 37 years, 35 years, I managed to sort of disconnect from the emotion of selling. I mean, there's certain things that obviously I absolutely love, but they were so expensive I couldn't possibly afford them. So there was never a question of me buying them. But I have a few very happy memories of things that I really did think were fantastic and I would love to have owned. But, you know, £38 million is not really quite in my bracket, unfortunately, you know, whatever it was. Actually, there was a wonderful picture by Rubens we sold in 2002 or 2003. And it was the greatest thing, I think, that's been on the auction block in the last 40 years, greater than any Giacometti, Picasso, or anything.
Right.
It was the greatest masterpiece. And it was called,
what was that, The Slaughter of the Innocents?
It was called, yes, absolutely. Okay, it was The Massacre of the Innocents.
Oh, Massacre of the Innocents.
And not everybody's subject, but it was a real, real masterpiece.
Yeah.
And it made £49.5 million.
Wow.
And I still regret that it didn't quite make 50. It was rather annoying. Another 500,000, but it was still the record for an old master picture at auction.
Yeah.
And that was, 12, 15 years, 13 years ago, yeah.
And what was the favourite piece that's ever come through Sotheby's?
Well, there've been a lot, really, but I mean, I some of the happy ones would be, there's a wonderful early Freud from, I think, 1944 called The Artist's Room, I think, which has sort of had a zebra looking. It was a marvellous picture, which I think we sold in about 95. The two wonderful Zoffanys of David Garrick and in his villa. Mm. There are lots of things, lots of amazing things. I mean, you know, I could go on all night. Right. But no, lovely. But, you know, you have to... I think when you sort of become a professional, you have to sort of be able to disconnect. Otherwise, you'd go nuts.
Absolutely.
I mean, I imagine it's like working in a sweet shop, you know, and being obsessed by Cadbury's Twirl or something. I mean, the temptation must be appalling. You've got to disconnect from that.
Yeah.
Funny enough, there was when I was brought up, I lived in Kent, and there was a man who ran the sweet shop locally. And whenever you went in there, he was always eating sweets. And you could just see, he was so fat, this bloke. And the poor man, he was an example of somebody who didn't do that because he was eating all his products the whole time. Right. So that's the other side of the web. But I, fortunately, have managed to control myself.
Okay. There was a great scandal, obviously, in the late 90s, early 2000s, between Christie's and Sotheby's of price fixing.
Yes.
I'm sure you weren't involved in that, but what was it like from the inside?
Well, it was horrendous, really, because we had no knowledge of it at all, and it was very upsetting for all of us. I mean, the story is well known, and unfortunately, there was this collusion between the two chief executives. And for the rest of us who were sort of, as it were, the sort of worker bees in the factory, we were going on as if life was normal. We had no knowledge of it, and it was very distressing when it happened, because all our good work was being, well, some of it was being sort of manipulated elsewhere.
Wow.
And I think we all were very disillusioned and upset about it. And actually, in many cases, a lot of us actually lost money, because the shares dipped to something like $6. And it was a very bad period, and it was actually humiliating. But, you know, genuinely, certainly my knowledge of everyone in Sotheby's, that nobody knew about it. Mm-hmm. We simply weren't involved. And there were obviously somebody at the top who was.
Yeah.
And it was very distressing, but we recovered, and I think we became stronger for it. And then we introduced more compliance. And actually, I think the auction houses, I think, are much more honourable places, probably. I mean, it was probably a bit of a wake-up call, but I think they are, I think on the whole, they're ethical. And, you know, I mean, Sotheby's, obviously, I know much better, but it's a public company, and therefore it's heavily scrutinised.
Yeah.
But it was a bad chapter, no question.
Sure. And having worked at Christie's and Sotheby's for long periods in both of their ways, what's it like from the inside, that rivalry? We often think of it kind of like maybe warring mafia factions that have got a grudging respect and a kind of...
Well, it's highly competitive.
Yeah.
And also, you sort of know your opposite number, because you probably go to pitches against him. And I think that the auction houses, they're very, very competitive. And, you know, the point about the art cake is only so big.
Sure.
And so Sotheby's and Christie's and, you know, me and my new guys, we're all trying to get a piece of this cake. And so it is very, very competitive. And, you know, basically what has happened is that the commissions have been driven way down. Mm. So although these companies sell a lot of art, $5-6 billion a year, the profits aren't really as good. I mean, they're not reflected in the turnover. And the reason is because it's a head-to-head battle.
Yeah.
And some of the margins at the top end are very, very small. I mean, they really are. So although they charge whatever they charge, big buyer's premium, they don't see a lot of it. It goes elsewhere, you know.
Why did you decide to leave Sotheby's last year?
Well, I'd done the same job for really 22 years, and I think that's about 15 years longer than you should do a job. I've always thought you should sort of change your job every 7 years.
Right.
But I was very happy and enjoyed it, and it seemed to, you know, we had a sort of certain amount of success. But I really, I think the time was right to move on for all sorts of reasons. But really, because I'd done it too long, and I think it was time to have a change. I'm not as young as I used to be, and I've got probably one more career in me. And so I thought, well, this is my moment, and that's why I left. Yeah.
What was the day-to-day job like? I mean, was it lots of lunches?
Well, it's very full on. And, you know, I started not particularly early, but probably 9 o'clock in the morning. But I probably had... I probably very rarely had 10 minutes when I could sit and drink a cup of tea and contemplate the world. I mean, it was absolutely full on at all times.
Is that 5 days a week, 7 days a week?
It was 5 days a week, but then, you know, I'd be schmoozing at the weekend. I mean, you know, I had a business lunch every day. I probably had at least two, sometimes three evening engagements where I'd take a charity auction, I reckon in my 22 years, I had 3,000 business lunches, 1,500 evening engagements.
Wow.
I probably took, I don't know, 500 sales and probably made 1,000 speeches. I don't know, but it was, you can see why you know, I had slightly run out of gas really by the end. And actually the lunches, which were very good. I mean, I ate very well, but I've actually lost quite a lot of weight since. And the reason is because I don't eat three-course lunches anymore, you know.
What are the kind of dark arts of the auctioneer?
I think you have to. A lot of it's a lot of funny bits, which are hard really to explain. But you have to vary your tone, your voice. You have to give a bit of variety. The thing about auctioneering is it's very easy to be very boring, I think. And attending auctions as I do now, you do see it a lot more from the audiences. Not that no names mentioned, but I think that it can be very, very boring sitting in an auction and listening to somebody with a very monotone voice. So I think you have to be able to vary the pace, vary the voice, vary the language, all of that, and do a bit of prodding, gentle prodding, a little bit of humour possibly. There are all sorts of little techniques that can work, you know. And because most people go to an auction and they don't really have a set bid. They say, I am going to bid around 20 million. No, that probably means that they'll spend 24 if you do the right sort of prodding.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, people very rarely stick to what they intend to bid. They do in wine sales, book sales, but in sort of multiple sales, but not in picture sales. You normally can extract another one.
Right. Because it's such a...
Well, because you always think, you see, if you think about it as a punter, you think that one more bid and I'll guess it. You know,
that's the trap.
Yeah, that is the trap.
It's kind of like
and
gambling.
You make people
that
think that. You see, that's the illusion. It's a bit like Paul Daniels, really. It's an illusion. You know, you're trying to make people in a way think that one more and you're going to get it. You know.
Yeah. And do people?
It's all about expressions. It's about the look with the eyebrow. It's the shrug of the. You know, it's lots of stuff.
Wow.
Lots of stuff that goes on that you do and intonation in the voice and. There's a lot that goes probably unnoticed, but is very much done for a reason.
It does sound like you miss it a bit when you talk about it like that.
Not really. I don't really, because I've sort of done it for such a long time, you know. And I think that I also strong believer and somebody else should have a go at it. You know, I did it for 22 years, which meant that
you're hogging
somebody it. Yeah, hogging it really. And I think, you know, there's some good auctioneers there, and they should have their chance.
Yeah.
I mean, if somebody asked me to do it, I'd do it, but I'm funny enough, I don't look back, really. I don't, you know.
Wow.
I don't. I mean, I you know, I enjoyed it. Also, I'd sort of got to where I could get to. I don't think I didn't need to prove anything else, really. Do you know what I mean? I'd sort of done it, really. I think a lot of people in all walks of life go on too long, whether it's boxers particularly. And, you know, don't you think? I mean,
because there's so much money in one more fight.
Well, no, that's true. But then you see opera singers going on too long, you know. You see rock singers going on too long.
Definitely.
And I'm not putting myself into that category. But as a sort of professional, I think, get out when you can still do it. And you've still got a bit of a brain, vaguely. Yeah. And, you know, I got out, well, I'm 63 now, but I got out at 62. And, you know, the best auctioneers like Christopher Bird, who was very good, he got out at the same time. And he actually told me, I mean, I hope he won't mind me saying this, is that he began to really not enjoy it. It was becoming a real problem for him. And he really was, and he was a great auctioneer. But I think there comes a point, probably when you're around 60, when you probably, you know, it begins to take a lot out of you.
Yeah.
And I think it takes a lot out of you. You know, people don't realize that. You sit down up there for an hour and a half. You're giving it your all. The concentration for an hour and a half. You know, concentration's never been my strong point.
Yeah.
You are exhausted at the end of it all.
So now you're doing Claw Wyndham, which is a kind of advisory brokerage.
Yes.
jack of all trades.
Life begins at 63, you know.
Absolutely. I'm sure that's my father's motto.
And this is exciting because when I decided to leave, so did Melanie Clore, who was my co-chairman at Sotheby's, and we had gone round Europe and really the world doing a lot of business for Sotheby's, and we get on extremely well. And you know, I was intending to leave, and I think she thought she would leave, and so we decided to form an alliance, and we've started this business, Clore Wyndham.
Yeah.
And it's very exciting, and we're doing well, and we really enjoy it. And it's a completely different pace, completely different game to what we were doing before, but we've taken to it well, and she's very talented, and we complement each other very well, and you know, I have no regrets at all. Yeah.
It's not a case of poacher turned gamekeeper at all. I know you're.
No, it's. I mean, you know, obviously we're fishing in the same pool, aren't
yeah.
we? I mean, you know, and we are obviously in competition with our old, both Sotheby's and Christie's and other dealers as well. But we also do business with the auction houses, so we collaborate and we do things with them. But you know, we're all, as I said to you before, this cake. We're
yeah.
all trying to get a piece of the cake. And but of course, we don't offer auctions. We offer private sales. We offer something different. We're very, very discreet. Nobody knows what we're up to. We are very transparent with the clients, so they know exactly what they're paying. But we are absolutely perfect for people who want discretion.
So with this new chapter of your life
yes.
opening up,
yes.
and you've been involved in art for so long, are you ever tempted to pick up a paintbrush yourself?
Well, I did. You're absolutely right. I did about 3 or 4 years ago, and it was a real disaster, actually, because I've got absolutely no talent. But I got into a sort of Mondrian phase,
okay.
and I started producing Mondrians, and I made the mistake of putting them into two of them, into the Sotheby's staff exhibition. And,
wow.
And they rather embarrassingly hung them in the main hall so everybody could see these ghastly pictures. Anyway, I got two very nice compliments. Two people said how much they liked the frames, and that was it. But they were so bad. So I've now retired again.
Okay.
That's certifiably appalling.
You were quite seriously injured a few years ago in a shooting accident.
Yes, I was shot badly, yeah.
And how did that kind of change your outlook on business, on life?
Well, that's a good question, really. I got shot very badly in my face and my hands and my chest. And the key was that I was wearing glasses, mm. and that saved my eyesight.
What brand of glasses were they?
This well, I was just wearing sort of regular glasses,
okay.
not shooting glasses. But
right.
the lenses were shot out. So, you know, I would have been blind
wow.
Had I not worn them. And I bled very badly. And it was a strange experience. But funny enough, it was a good experience. I mean, that sounds a strange thing to say, because it made me think, really value how lucky I was that I, you know, I was within a millicenter of a millimeter, probably is the right word, of of losing my eyesight, which would completely change my life.
Of course,
I mean, that would be the end of my career,
yeah.
end of everything. And it made me think very carefully about it. So I went off to see a plastic surgeon to sort of have the pellets dug out of my face. And actually, I also wanted my chins removed and my eyes done. But anyway, sadly, he didn't do any of that. And he couldn't really remove the pellets, so
oh,
they're
wow.
all in my face still.
Really?
Yeah, you know, I had a shot in my mouth and my throat and everything.
Do you anyway. Buzz when you go through?
No, I don't know. So, but it was fine, actually. And, you know, and I got over the sort of trauma, actually, remarkably well. But what I did was I took a view that because I was so fortunate that I wanted to sort of repay somebody. Mm. You know, I'm not a particularly religious man, but I felt that somebody was on my side. So I then decided to raise money for this charity called Orbis. And Orbis is an amazing charity, O-R-B-I-S, which basically helps restore the sight
yeah.
in third world countries. So let's say Ethiopia. Ethiopia has a population of 82 million people, of which 4 million are partially sighted or blind,
mm-hmm.
and of those 4 million, 3.2 million do not need to be. If they lived in a country like this country,
yeah.
they would have an operation on cataracts. So you've got 3.2 million people who are not necessarily, you know, should be able to see. And that was I thought that was a terrible fact. So I decided to go and raise money. So I don't know if you know, but I walked across England. I did a walk. I did a thing called the Coast to Coast Walk with a friend of mine and raised just under £1 million, which was great because what I got from the charity was that I wanted every penny to go towards, not towards secretarial backup or anything. I wanted that. And we worked out that on average, £10 saved the sight of one person.
Wow.
And that could be cataract operations, could be trachoma operations, could be antibiotics, or could be a pair of glasses. So we basically changed the sight or have of about 90,000 people.
Incredible.
So it was. It felt really good. And then I went to Mongolia to see what was happening there. And then, after having gone to Ethiopia, we then went around it, which was a very, very therapeutic experience. I took two of my sons with me.
Yeah.
And we went to Lalibela. We worked all around. And we went. And what we noticed was in these sort of hospitals and clinics they had, which are fairly basic, they had no equipment.
Mm.
I mean, they literally had nothing. I mean, very little. So I then got myself into raising more money to buy the equipment. So we raised another £500,000 for some really good equipment. So we did make a bit of a difference. And I must say, I felt that was all very gratifying.
Yeah.
And, you know, my kids came and we watched her. We saw an old lady of 80 come in and have a cataract operation. She'd be blind for 6 years and she could see, and it was an amazing thing.
Yeah.
She'd walked 100 kilometers to get there.
Wow.
And she was operated by this man in a hut with the most basic equipment. You've never seen anything like it. I mean, the sterilizing unit was so basic. It was like a sort of electric kettle. It was like one of those tea urns, but the plug had a square socket, so she and he had a round plug, so he had to sort of do a bit of, I mean, it was awful, but we've done a bit and hopefully made a bit of a difference to a few people there. But sight, if you're sort of going to lose your sight, it is something that does make you think very, very carefully.
Yeah.
And so I think it was a very positive thing. I'm it's a funny thing to say, but I'm almost quite glad I did get shot because I would never have done it otherwise, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm fine. I'm not traumatized. I can see. I don't have any after effects at all. I've got a lot of lead in my face, but other than that, it's fine.
Wonderful. Right. Henry Wyndham, thank you very much for coming to speak to us.
Pleasure.
Thank you very, very much for listening to this episode of the Gentleman's Journal podcast. We'll be back in a fortnight with more invaluable insights from the world of entrepreneurs. But until then, you can find us on our website, which is www.thegentlemansjournal.com. Or if you're so inclined, follow us on Instagram at The Gents Journal, or indeed on Twitter at The Gents Journal. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you very, very soon.